anchovies today.
Richard
is a very large fan of anchovies. I promised him we will give him some.
I've been promised anchovies.
I love them too.
Yeah.
Richard, the semester is not over yet.
This one is.
We're gonna move right into very much presentations and not respecting their time. Hearing none. Actually, what we should do is also go around and introduce ourselves because we have guests. This is a particular reason we want to do that. So I'll start. Matthew Tagli, I'm a second year dual JDMBA, undergrad class 2016, and welcome.
Tim DeVogue, one of the co-chairs.
I'm Andrew Money, I am the University Review Board Chair.
Phil Sisney, Administrative Chair.
Richard Bensall, I am the faculty senate representative of the University Center.
Ryan Parker, the Associate Judicial Codes Counselor.
I'm Lisa Lieberwitz, on the CJC as a faculty and faculty senate.
Tom Overton, I'm a faculty member in College of Animal Science and the University Board Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being here. I know we've been playing email tag for quite a while.
And Rita.
I'm a sophomore in ILR. I'm Margaret. I'm the clerk of the Code and Judicial Committee.
And we also have Priscilla, who's an associate judicial administrator, who's a guest. Carlton Riley, who's an undergrad, stepped out, looks at me on a phone call, but he'll be back. So first off, thank you so much for being here. I know we've been playing email tag for a while. It's so good to finally have you here. We had Chris Futrell here in the fall, and it was a rigorous discussion. We're glad to have you here. So if there's any, I sent along, I guess, a brief set of questions that have been passed by the committee. If there's anything you want to ask on that, I know, Joel, you said that you and Chris and Lee were going to look at the procedures and how they would operate. If you want to provide any information on that, I know it's in process. Mm-hmm. Just provide information if you have any, just so that the committee has something to suggest when they start figuring out what they need to figure out. Just one of the questions they want to ask.
All right. In short, I've been working up a small list of possibilities for everybody. My goal is to work both with the chairs as well as the entire pool. Yes, turns out one of your nice little documents here. The administrative chair acknowledges he's been derelict in keeping up certain duties, which is the goal for the coming year. This includes revision of the hearing board procedures in concert with you, which I see as a topic of business tonight. Training for members may make procedures go a lot faster if everybody is already familiar with the subject matter and, well, yes, the subject matter, I'll leave that for now. Opportunity for benchmarking what other universities do. How far out of band are we? Do we need to be that way, for instance? And some work has been done on that already by the UDA's office. Also, opportunities just for greater involvement and thus familiarity with hearing board procedures. If we have one, usually it would be a student, I would imagine, taking over the hearing reporting logistics rather than having someone else, a neutral third party, if you will, uninvolved, but also taking part just by being there. So, the support us.
So, I guess, is any of the chairs have anything they want to add? Anything you just find out? Just a general, what are the boards, anything you see that's difficult in your positions? Anything about the code you find hard to adjudicate? And of course, my favorite question, what can we do to help you in your roles to make you guys make life easier? Are there areas of code to clarify? Is there support we can provide?
I can't listen as fast as you can talk.
I can slow down, I'm sorry.
take a breath.
Thank you. I thought I just ran over, so I'm still kind of slow down. But in general, is there anything that this committee can do to help the hearing board chairs to make their lives easier in terms of clarification of the code, whether there's a difficult in the code, right? The code version that creates trouble when it's the process of adjudication, procedures, or just general logistics that you think you might be able to help with, or at least provide an amplification of it to other offices of the university to provide support?
I'll tell you my experience, and I'm only speaking for myself. What I find is if there's any question about the code or concern, we have an attorney in the university counsel's office who's assigned to us during a hearing. He's available by phone. And I find that extremely helpful. So if we have a question of code interpretation, we'll just call him. And, you know, that's code interpretation. I have not personally found that the code is so obscure or difficult. I think it's pretty straightforward. I honestly, and I've got to speak for myself first, I think our procedures that we've got need a lot more. Because I think our procedures are sometimes in conflict with the code. When that's the case, I follow the code because the code is the interpretative document. The only other thing I would say is, I don't know if this group has any way to do this, but I think if we had an expanded pool of panel members, that would really help. Because I think one of the things that really holds up the process is that the JA's office is spending a lot of time trying to find people to participate, which may mean that they don't have the panel until the day before the hearing is supposed to happen. And then these people get, you know, these huge documents to try to digest. So I think if we had more people that were available. I will say one more thing.
Of course, please.
One of the things I realized when people come onto a panel is that they don't necessarily want to follow the code because at the very end, they'll go through the whole process and then get to the very end and say, oh yeah, but it's gonna ruin their life. Or, oh yeah, but they're gonna, you know, it's gonna be on their permanent record. And I feel like we need to really work with our panel members and say, you know, if you're going to do this, you have to be ready to follow the procedures that are laid out in the code in terms of this is the consequence for this behavior. I don't know. That's my experience. People back up at the last minute.
Sure.
Out, in my opinion.
Absolutely. So, I just, Richard, do you want to add a question on that?
Yes. That's very important. Really, really helpful. What is the reason, in your opinion, all of this is in your opinion.
Yeah.
But what is the reason why, what is the reason why procedures in the code have drifted out of whack?
Honestly, I think the procedures were not written very clearly. They haven't been revised in a while. And I think they're just not clear. So they don't account for all the permutations of what could happen. I think they're just not clear.
So we should work on that.
I think that's, I mean, I don't know whose job it is. Joel and I have agreed to kind of start working on them. I don't know whose responsibility is, but I think Joel and I have felt like that's kind of the chair's role.
And it was historically, it has been the boards and the administrative chair would spearhead that. I mean, in some of the code changes, actually, first, in terms of expanding the hearing board pool, it's something actually we looked at a couple of years ago. We have been told it wasn't necessarily something that needed to be done, something that we can do, and we can expand the pool, and it sounds like there's a desire to do so, we can do so. When we do selections from the pool, we always have, traditionally, we get 100 some odd applicants, we rank them on a scale of 1 to 5. The hardest time we have is we generally have the 5 top candidates. We generally have more people than we have seats. So expanding the pool under staffing, it wouldn't necessarily be that difficult for us. It's just a matter of changing the language of the code, we can do. So that's what the committee is interested in.
Well, let me ask my co-chairs if they agree with what I just said. And Michelle. Is that your sense, Tyler?
Yeah, so I'll comment on a couple things you said. I would second that the access to counsel for a chair and the board is really, really helpful. I found that access in both the hearings I've chaired to date been really helpful. The procedures, I guess I haven't found them as confusing, although right before I chaired the last hearing, Michelle sent out a whole pile of resources by email attachment that actually was additional, I might say checklist type stuff, but a sanctioning guide and things like that. So that
yes.
Actually were helpful.
Yes.
Very helpful.
Yes.
In that, and all that, I do, from last hearing, we did wrestle a bit in terms of understanding what the connection was, and maybe it's there in the volume of ration, which is hard to figure it out or ferret it out, but, you know, what is the implications of X sanction on which record the student has? You know, is it a temporary thing? Is it a permanent, you know? And that was hard, a little bit hard to, maybe it's in that section guide, and we're just trying to wrestle out all the information. That was hard, but that was one thing that it does pop up. I didn't have quite the same experience, at least with the one of you know, the board saying, well, you know, we don't want to do this because of X. So it did come in, all of it actually did come into play.
I've had it a couple of times.
This probably was discussed, or maybe it should have been discussed with us because there just wasn't clarity around it. So,
yeah. And this new Jeff was that you helped me provide some of that.
And I think the hard thing with the director's attention is that our office will always say return reprimand is our baseline. The Office of the JCC is strongly advocating for the oral warning, but even philosophical proof it uses, so sometimes you have brought up. But yeah, I agree, that's something that the board's always wrestling with. And, you know, I don't want to really advise, and what's the community safety balance? And you know, show me one person who didn't get into a law school for everyone underage drinking, and I'll look at some data with that. But no, I agree with Andrew, some of the sanctions. It needs to not have an appeal, which that's funded. But with the staff and the boards, Gabe actually disappointed me. There was a proposal prior to the president to expand the boards. Our hardest constituency class is faculty, to keep staff. Students tend to be pretty quick in their response. Staff members are extremely well in responding. And so when we think about expanding the staffing of the boards, one of the things we always think about, how can we have robust training to make sure that they're able to make decisions that require additional training. And that's something that Joel and I talked about, and Kendall as well, you know, what sort of additional training we provide to the board. So just expanding it so that if we do, we can make sure that we have adequate training.
Absolutely. I had recent speakers, but also just finally, part of the amendments I had said that were related to the boards this morning, right? Was in terms of we're looking at expediting the process or making it easier if a board member is derelict to have them unseated from the boards. For instance, if they're not attending or they're not responsive, to make that a process that's easier to follow and clarifying that. We're also looking, CDC is interested in looking at the procedures in terms of how can we make sure that they are aligned with the code. I mean, we want to work with the boards to try and make sure that works for everyone. And also, if I might ask Michelle, you can get a copy of that sentence and guys write it certainly. Maybe we have a minute. Excellent.
Yeah. Well, and I'm really interested in hearing from everybody. Thanks a lot for kicking it out here. I guess I have a couple questions based on some of the things you said. One was the having the university general counsel's office answer questions about how to interpret the code. It seems a little odd to me to ask somebody who's not really who has a stake in the outcome, maybe not directly, but who, you know, might not be viewed as really dispassionate. I always avoid the word neutral, given whatever that means, but at least for some sense of neutrality or impartiality, it would seem odd to me to go to the general counsel's office because you're going to get a point of view about what the code means. Now, it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be some place to go, right, for information, but is there any concern now on that?
I will tell you, in practice, I have not. Mm-hmm. And usually it's not a protracted, mm-hmm. you know. It generally is more where the panel is struggling with, I can't think of an example, but it might be a phrase. What does this mean? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't feel like it's my role to interpret the code mm-hmm. in the practice, so that's what I do.
Mm-hmm. Whose role is it? Sorry, whose role is it to interpret the code?
Well, that was my understanding that it was the university council's.
But his assignment is specifically to support us, not support the university.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I know he works for him.
True, but I will tell you in my experience working with him, now again, maybe I'll interpret it differently, but this particular individual I have found to come across as truly not having a dog in this fight mm-hmm. either way. Really was helpful with not only at times interpretation, but also process, correct process. Mm-hmm. And so, I leaned on him a bit to say, okay, let's make sure we're doing this right.
And I can picture the process. I mean, it just seems to me it might be something we want to look at, because I'm so surprised to hear that you're asking, you know, that from the hearing board, you're asking, you know, the council office for advice about what the code means. So, I mean, I just think it's an important issue. And then just, if I could just follow up, this issue about when, you know, having people on hearing boards who are willing to really apply the code. I mean, I went to the training before I got on here. I was going to be on the hearing board, and you were there. This is quite a while ago. And I was one of the few people who was kind of a, and of course Michelle, you there. I was one of the people who was really taking a much more liberal interpretation, in certain ways liberal, I guess, politically and in certain ways in terms of, well, it's a couple, let me just back. I was taking more of a strict constructionist approach, I think, to reading the code and saying, I don't think this person's behavior in our little hypotheticals goes into it. And I remember your position was far more harsh, in my view, about finding people to be to have violated the code in our hypothetical. So it seems to me that one person's views of somebody being unwilling to apply the code may be another person's view that I don't actually think the code applies here in the way that one says.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you, Lisa, but in my experience, it's not so much did this person violate the code as if they've agreed. I mean, they'll agree that this person has, and then the next step is then what do we do? And that's when everything comes to a screeching halt, and they're not willing to apply. And again, I haven't done a hearing since Michelle wrote this sanctioning, which I think is really going to help. But I just was really struck by the. It's almost like, you know, the idea of people, this is a bad analogy to make, but death penalty attorneys want people who are at least willing to consider the death penalty, because otherwise everybody gets thrown off the jury who says, no, I wouldn't even ever consider that. And so then all you have is a jury full of people say, yeah, let's go for the death penalty. Mm-hmm. This is kind of the reverse of that, where you have people saying, you know, yes, they did it. What's the sentence? Well, no, I don't want that sentence because I feel like it's too.
So maybe it is an issue of more individualized sentencing as opposed to finding somebody violent.
To me, it's people not wanting to apply the sanctions that correlate with the value of the crime.
Yeah. No, that's interesting, though.
I'm not a prosecutor.
And you'll get different perspectives within every single board. You know, you'll let individuals come to that board through their own lenses. Look at the code and interpret it. You know, again, we're all individuals. And that's one of the challenges of chairing these things is that you don't know. It's not all one.
No, I understand. Yeah. I was just trying to kind of probe a little bit more in terms of is it an issue of are the sanctions sensitive enough to a range of views? Is that the issue as opposed to, well, I don't want to apply the code per se in terms of finding somebody in violation?
I have. Michelle and then Carlton, it is actually kind of correct. In terms of the baseline sanction, it used to be OJA prior to Michelle, the baseline was oral warning. Michelle in her discretion has changed her baseline to a written reprimand, and the JCC's office, my understanding, has always supported the prior standard. But it is good to have a discussion about that, but just to note that the baseline standards can change, and this hearing guide, I'm sure, or sentencing sanction guide, I'm sure, we'll have a discussion in this committee for. So I have a question, Michelle.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about, I just wanted for the attorney, so the attorney that advises the boards doesn't advise the OJ, so there's two separate functions. So the way that was explained to me is that the code is a trustee's document, and so one of the responsible offices is the Office of General Counsel. So if you have questions about the policy, including the Office of the Assemblies and things of that nature, so I just want to make sure that there's a clarification that they do have separate.
But both within university council's office.
Yeah. But so the guy called one attorney in the board.
That's an interesting question.
So I had a question for you. In cases where the board is hesitant to apply whatever penalty to charge the breach or the violation they've seen in the code, is there like, what is the action that happens after that? Do people tend to downplay the charge, or do they just, like, try to, like, give an alternative penalty? What exactly happens there?
I don't know that they downplay the charge as much as downplay what I would consider the correlating penalty. They go they drop it down.
Okay.
So, and I'm talking, I'm the university review board chair, so this is after that it's been to a hearing board and the person appeals. And so it's fairly egregious behavior. I mean, this is, and you know, maybe some of these were before the Title IX stuff came up, so there were a lot of sexual harassment. People with guns, I mean, not serious stuff, not, you know, I don't think to mean other things, but what I would consider serious behaviors that you would say, you know, this person, really, we need to have them on campus for a while anyway. And, you know, it is interesting because people talk about the record. Well, what does that mean? What is going to be on their record? We don't know what that means. But they get very hesitant to apply it.
I wonder if that's partly because there's not really clarity. I mean, does it show up on a transcript? You know, the
exactly.
Transcript, does it show up on some other disciplinary record? University, you know, that's that I think is where, you know, clarity there is really going to
be. That's something for the yearly training when we talk about a no record. We've got the transcript.
What is
we've
the
got
record?
The required reporting for graduate school.
Right.
That might be worth touching on.
And I don't even remember, Michelle, maybe, I'm sorry, you know.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I think Michelle said this, but just like questioning, are we evaluating the safety of the campus in this decision, or are we evaluating like the, you know, implications that it has for an individual? I don't personally want an individual to have to like do more than they have to. Like, I'm not trying to be overbearing and penalize people, but I think that in considering the safety of our campus, maintaining the, you know, strong ability of our judicial system to, you know, make people aware of what can happen when they like are out of line and when they violate the code, I think that like it's an important distinction. And so I just am curious to know how people view that distinction of, you know, being sure that we're viewing the code and like violations of the code as more egregious than whatever potential repercussions that this person who has already been heard could have on their record, as if they did not deserve the treatment that the code already has said is like appropriate.
Exactly. And I don't know the answer to that. I think that's exactly the question. That's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
But I think that in most cases, the JA suggests a penalty if the person is found to have committed the action. But it's a selection out of a range that the code covers. And so there is. It's possible to typically go and be more severe or less severe than what the JA recommends, and which does give the possibility in the hearing board of deciding how egregious the circumstances were.
There are, if you look at those who aren't aware, the hearing board decisions are on public record. Obviously, they are redacted. About the certain parts of the board members, but they're public, and you can go through and look at Michelle Logs and read through. I have read through all the ones that I can find recently, but they do provide their instances where the JA recommended X. The hearing board will add more. There are times where the hearing board will add less. It really, the system is built to allow the board's discretion, knowing that yes, you committed X violation, but to commit X violation can have a lot of various things going into that, and to allow the instance the board to assess that without being said, okay. You did X, there's a mandatory minimum, except for the most egregious circumstances.
Yeah, one of the questions that has come up in our own deliberations, repeatedly, has been discussion about the length of time it takes to adjudicate a case and what the sources of delay would be and how. Those can be out. You can address those. I mean, there are two ways of doing it. The big connection, the big connection is with orders of no contact and how to set those up so that they jive with the normal, or consistent with the normal practice of the hearing boards. So, what is the major a major source of delay in lawyer cases. If it's a serious case.
Watch what you're saying now.
No, if it's a serious case where a person might be suspended or told to withdraw, frequently they'll have a lawyer, and frequently they'll have a lawyer who's busy. And so you'll say, I have this trial and this one coming. I can't do anything for 3 weeks. Or longer.
And you have to, I mean, if somebody wants to be represented, you can't say no. And of course, if it's the respondent in the situation, I suppose they're the one who's harmed by delay, so if they're agreeing to the delay, although that leaves the complainant without any resolution.
And once the chair gets a charge letter, I mean, it can take variable amounts of time. It's what it's supposed to be 21 days to hear it. But, like, you know, again, they want the running right into the finals or as soon as we gone, so it kicked in, you know, until after we got something that does get happen. Those things do happen, and they're done for the schedule of the chair. And the chairs are, you know, when I get, they're signed. I suppose if you say I'm gone for 3 months, you know, I can email back and say, you know what, I better find somebody else. But there's schedule that way, and then there's schedule the student. And they obviously try to make sure they're hoping something works, even if it takes a little longer. But recognize them as in some cases do get drawn out. So,
is there any other major sources in there?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it tends mostly to be the schedule. I would say with some cases, when you look at a hazing case, those tend to be complex. And so you're in a group of probably 80 people to be doing a thorough investigation. So, but I agree, some of it is we always defer to the student's cause or choice. And so usually you're invited to just put incidents occur, right? So we look at either the first 2 weeks of school being a busy time, mid-October, and then we look at February as being a jam-packed time. So when you think about just the academic calendar, you're running into breaks. But I think that's just, I will say over the past 2 years, we've expedited the timelines. And I think some of that is just because policy 6.4 on August 1st of 16 moved all those cases over there. So I don't think it was necessarily anything that we've implemented, but I do think that we're within about 39 days of adjudication, complaint to conclusion, not a coming appeal, which is decent. It's 18 days more longer than the code initially allowed. So.
That includes the SDA. That's not hearings. That includes everything. SDA grievances.
That includes everything. So SDAs can usually be resolved within 4 or 5 days.
Would you think that 39 days is like 7 months.
No, I agree. There are two parts to the question. One is, there anything we can do about that? Mm-hmm. Something. And then the second is, we need a for renewal of no contact with other kinds of work. We need some kind of deal for what this looks like from your end. So one of the questions that came up is different ways of doing processing requests for a renewal of a no contact order.
Interim sanctions. So in essence, prior to the hearing, there are an interim no contact, an interim suspension,
right.
Other interim measures.
And so one of them was to have a full board do this. One of them was to have just hearing board chairs. Another was, if I remember right, was to have hearing board chairs collectively do this.
It's the back of.
Oh, it's the back.
It's the back.
The
receiving party.
So I'm just repeating what it said. So that is the question to you: is which do you think would work best?
I would say having the hearing board chairs do something collectively is not. Wait, let's see here. How many? You can't get. Michelle keeps trying to get it. Get an annual meeting. I think it happened last year. It's just people busy. So I would never recommend that.
Absolutely. With the right context, in terms of looking at the no contact, the interim no contact directives, what the committee was looking at our last meeting, some of the rough agreement was to make it so that the hearing board chair can have no interim no contacts have a set duration. If the DA wishes to extend or renew them, it would go before an entity to be a rotating hearing board chair. So it would be Professor DeVoe would do one, okay, then you did one, and the next it would be Professor Overton. As it's trying to have some variety of looking at them so you don't have to have that, but still understand that you're not going to try and pull together boards really quickly with the hope that, but yes, pool is large enough that you can still rotate through it and go through again and again, but to allow somewhere so you don't have intermeasures being used for too long, but also ensuring that it's not too onerous to use them where they might actually get access. That's what we've been trying to do.
And that's parallel to the current system for cases that could result in a suspension where it needs concurrence by one of the chairs for Michelle.
Of course, it's a suspension. What this is saying, that if there's a no contact director that's being issued, which I haven't issued one in 2 years, I received requests. If I want to do, beyond that, for an interim suspension, there can be a full hearing board to challenge whether or not the temporary suspension was appropriate. But if I were to issue a no contact directive, I would have to go to you and say, okay, I'd like to issue it this for 21 days.
With this set of facts?
Yeah.
I would say, makes sense.
And then after 21 days, I have to respond with something back to you.
If people think that that's appropriate, I think that's fine.
But I know that we are coming up on the time we have allocated. So I want to thank Mary Ward. I don't want to ask you any final questions for the committee. Hearing not answers, I would ask one final question. Is there anything concrete, looking at training, looking at training for a while, or all that else to do with them? Is there anything else that you think would be beneficial for us to help with in terms of, I know we don't generally check in with you, which is like in our goal is moving forward to try and have more regular contact, obviously, getting everyone together. Challenge, but our goal is to really try to be supportive because even looking at the procedures and the rewrite, the public hearing last year actually put out high everything that I had received. And I had email, DPC, and the JDOC to get a copy of them. So we're very interested in trying to help ensure that the transparency and the procedures are working because at the end of the day, the code has a lot in it, but the way it actually works is where the rubber meets the road. And if it's not working in that regard, then people can say whatever it likes, but it's not going back.
Like the second or third earlier, of having somebody or some committee look through the procedures in the code in those little details, because they're just, it's not malicious at all, but just over however many years, gradually things have just gotten misaligned, which shows up clearly when something happens that is unusual, like the public.
Thank you so much.
So a couple things real quick. First one on the plain language expressing public hearing. We basically that prepared remember the room is that a package one we discussed last week, but this is the one about moving the public hearing times forward.
In other words,
I think that's to my standpoint on that's a great change, potentially because I was able to remember hearing last year that we surface because of that. I want to put a longer timeline, a longer timeline to plan and make sure we got stuff ready like that would be really helpful. I don't have any comment on that. My other comment,
the code says in this that the audience should be in a separate location from
the code.
My set of code and having reference it. Prior public hearings, the code seems to be told, although it's not quite clear, that they should be possible in the same location, and that's something that we discussed after the hearing, knowing it became a black version. It became a bit of a commotion because it was done 2 days in advance. It's also why we're trying to move it back so that there's more time to book a room and figure out how we want to handle this.
I talked to Kevin Claremont, who wrote the code.
Yes.
And said, if I read the code as saying, and I know this is not how your office read it, but I read it as saying separate location. You're in a separate location, Christina, because you're not at the table. I know you interpret it as a different room, and Kevin said that's how it was traditionally done in a different room. But I would really recommend we look at that because it seems to me it's personal. I think it's silly to have people in another room with some kind of closed circuit TV. I get it as saying you're not at the table, but you're able to hear what's going on and there'd be some conflict.
So as a board member at that time, too, was that particular hearing. The motion and the charge among the student body was such that I'm not sure there could have been the same rule with us speaking, you know, it was pretty.
I think with a large room it would have worked, and I think that it would have just taken the chair when everyone was there to say these are the rules we can work under. But with having a very tiny room and having a large crowd outside that couldn't get inside. That really messed things up.
I was in the public room. I thought that's very much. And the people in that room, honestly, you could have heard a pin drop what was going on. People were respectful. I mean, in the regular location, it was really, people were trying, the angst was, even the office location was small, or should we be in the same room? That was the angst. The angst was not so much. I think people understood the gravity of, this is a hearing. This is not a place to make a statement. You're here to observe. And I mean, there was a police department officer who was kind of the volunteer's time, and the implication that here's what you do. If you don't, you're going to be invited to leave. And I believe, I agree with you. If we had time to have a larger room, that we could have made it work.
I think that's one of the so that was one of the issues with the procedures. I think it's really easy. It's like the code says public hearing, the procedures actually limited by state to 12 separate states. Mm-hmm. And so I think cutting that part of the procedures is an easy solution. Mm-hmm. I think we would actually have to change code or set your procedure. I think it's on the right-hand side of the last page of the UHB procedures.
Andrea and I dissected that just to be sure that was one of the big things we talked about. And yes, it turns out it isn't terribly clear, and I perhaps we could agree common sense would dictate if we could have grabbed, I don't know, one of the big, staff or auditorium or wherever, that would have been just fine for everybody, and we wouldn't have to worry about technology issues or separate spaces. Yeah.
My other comment, sorry, was on the report removal process, which I haven't experienced any of this, but we're also talking about wanting things here too, or searching things out. I mean, the current language seems to give the chair a fair amount of latitude relative to how that process unfolds. The proposed language makes it much more procedural and much more drawn out, potentially, because it says you got to get 14 days notice the first year or move, and I mean, so I don't know in what situation that would be applied, whether somebody,
in context, actually, Michelle was kind of, we met in January, and the concern was, right now it says the hearing board chair. I personally read it to be, it was written at a time when there was only a single chair. That being said, right now, what is the hearing board chair? Is the chair the collection of all the chairs? Is it one chair? That's since there was ambiguity. And the talk when we met was, okay, well, let's have the hearing board chairs do it. The hearing board chairs can vote on it. There was concern also that, well, the hearing board members are put in by the community through the UA and this committee. If we're doing a removal process, why not just have the hearing board chairs tell us, and then we can do it? We're happy to discuss that. But the rationale was the idea that if the community is appointed them, the community in theory would be the community's representative would be the body that would say, thank you for your service, but you're no longer on the board.
And it doesn't include the chairs.
Yeah,
there's no method to get the chairs out.
Mm-hmm. The short of us going to the president's office and asking about it. There's no formal process for that.
Yeah. Since the Office of the Judicial Administrator is responsible for staffing boards, I'm specifically thinking Janie is ultimately responsible for facilitating the process. To make her life that much easier, would it be appropriate for her, using as few people as possible, would it be appropriate to have her make this request, or would this ultimately have to be run through the chair? All right. Okay.
This could be more than just for not showing up. It could be somebody who comes and just drop their there. But you wouldn't know that.
like if they, one of the things we have people turn in their honors at the end. So if they were not turn it in, usually it would turn into the chair. So if the chair was, you know, they do this during deliberations or in the part that's closed off from either one of our offices, you know, being part of the, we've had some conversations with some chairs about some of the things that were said in deliberations that were a little bit of concern that we just wouldn't have known about or something that's just possible.
Because also what we do is, generally, if you're on the boards, is it once you're appointed by us, and we lost an application, we just redid our application, but we don't necessarily know how, you can write a lot of nice things on a piece of an application. Hearing from the boards is, and the chairs is something we're looking interested in terms of not just for their determination to be removed, but also their term is up. Maybe we should renew the term. Because traditionally, if we can formalize it, traditionally, once you're on, if you want to stick around, it's occurred to be a great appointment. You're assuming there's no red flags, and to be able to hear, if there are red or yellow, it is an issue. We want to hear about it because then it wouldn't be a courtesy appointment. It'd be, okay, we need to have a discussion. Should they be back on the pool? And that's a discussion that would happen at the time. But the key is to ensure that we're communicating so that we're not just inadvertently putting problems back in your lap just because we didn't know that there are problems.
Okay, so
any other, do you want to add anything else? That's okay. So thank you. I really appreciate that. Actually, I will. Well, thank you so much for coming. I if any comments or the committee, I will have them throw along email. I know we'll be in touch, assuming these code changes are in the process, but they're publicly vetted. I'll be happy to be in touch. I will follow up with those who are. I know Professor Petrell had, unfortunately, had something fall on, so she wasn't able to attend. Professor, she had damage.
She fell,
yes. She said she had hurt. Yeah, so she's fine now, she's recovering, but she couldn't make it. So she sends her regrets. I have Mr. Scans at class, so I will be sure to ask him I'll fill him in. But thank you so much. Please consider your pizza on your way out. We really appreciate it. And if you have anything that you think we should be aware of, please feel free to reach out at any time.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, thank you so much. I will make sure this goes through. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
From my perspective, this is going to be kind of hard.
Yeah.
Good night.
Did you
have any more questions? I'm just going to have some more questions.
Okay. So, actually, next up, Lisa, will be a brief update for you if you have any. I know we're going to be tomorrow.
That's just that we're
going to be tomorrow. Okay. That's, I anticipated it wouldn't be much because it would be a PRB. Very good thing tomorrow. I was in working. We're going to be tomorrow in 1:63 at 2 o'clock. There'll be an agenda once we have it, once we're in rooms. As well, there will also be next Wednesday at 3:30, also 1:3, that will be going to broadcast. That leads us back to the last bit in terms of the housekeeping code changes, the last one there, actually building these things with shared items, we may have more to add next week. But in terms of that brings us back to the no contact directives. What I did is based off the rough consensus we had at our last meeting, I went through and rewrote the proposal based off a 21-day base, a rotated hearing board chair looking at it, a paper hearing with copies of submissions both, as well as a retention hearing for 21 days. This was based off a consensus that I thought was emerging in the last meeting, and the committee is always free to change or modify it. It was more or less an idea of just finding some forms to allow through the hearing. The first thing to do is I have to go.
Hearing with the chair is probably not having an issue with negotiating that. I just would be careful with the word hearing because the code is very specific to what it means to have a hearing. You're asking for a paper submission for review, you're asking for the parties to make something else to buy it. So if you use the term hearing, that makes it all the people. So you need to have to do that.
I tried to describe it as a renewal request, so if you can tell us what you're going to be hearing. I missed it.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I also where the notices, the chair shall have access to all relevant conducting issues. And if I read the connection issues. So you know, the parties don't have access to all the necessary materials, but somebody's saying that one of those contracts that they can have to place, and then that's extended to both parties. You're really not deserving the charge of the investigation. So I think that's something that, and if the chair, like there's a lot of information that we don't present to the chair here. That, and also sometimes you disclose it, there's that fault that occurred, things like that. So, just as you guys arrive, just thinking everything in the vision. So, the chairs don't usually typically have access to materials, they have a fact pattern. So, if you look at the language of maybe a joint carry, there's something we talked about, you know, a creation of facts or things of that nature. Relevant, and so I think that makes sense to maybe look at some of that. There's Brian's eyes out, I'm going to point out some of that, but then when you think about written statements, we can be usually just one of the parties to choose the group pages and provide it. So, that's what you intend, I think that's
sort of summary.
Yeah, but you're putting the onus again on the two parties who are going through a pretty difficult situation. No contract. So you're telling them every 21 days they have to submit a reason why they're still in fear of someone, or why they think that their behavior is still applies to a level of meeting that, which means that they might disclose some information that they don't just plan on, and it's against the advice of counsel. And so if you're thinking about these 21 days, for the complainant, you're putting a pretty strong onus of having to disclose and continue to fear. For the respondent, you might be putting a disproportionate financial burden if you're having them work with an attorney every 21 days to do no contact record, which is probably what, 3 billable hours. So just when we're starting to think about that timeline, that's some other concerns that have come up as I talked to campus partners in office.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Based on the, I know you were able to last week, I just came there in. She had some excellent points that we tried to incorporate. The intent for the hearing board chairs investigative materials was there was a concern that the hearing board chairs should not be represented. I don't think they would want to represent. The goal is to ensure they have enough access to enough information to make a reasonable determination. So if we can find language that satisfies that concern, obviously if there's something that we don't provide, even in a full hearing, I personally don't think the committee they should tweak that language. In terms of the written statements, talking about procedures, actually, we wanted to limit them to 2-3 pages. I think that would work. I didn't put in procedures, or we can rewrite that as well. The intent of what I was attempting to encapsulate was that the written statements were meant to be if you want to submit something there. Instead of being a man, you must submit a statement. If you desire as a party to say, I want to make sure the hearing board chair sees X, Y, and Z, I can, but I don't have to. And the same idea is that If both parties sit there and say, we don't think we need an internal contact anymore, that would be irrelevance to the chair. Or if both parties say, we still really want one, that would also be irrelevance to the chair in making a decision. The goal is to try and ensure that the chair has information. And I have Richard's
speaker. So this brings up the question that we talked about before, which is the 21-day renewal, is that automatic? I think you thought it was. No, it's not.
It would have to be done by the chair. Would have to sign off on it.
No. I understand that part, but neither the complainant or the respondent has to request a renewal.
No, but the OJA does.
But that request from the OJA is automatic.
No.
So at the end of 21 days, they can just travel. Huh. That's our question.
So not absolutely. So the way it's way. It's intended to word it. So in essence, the OJA has the discretion to put a 21-day interim contract in. The OJA can do that. To ask for renewal after 20 days after the hearing board chair. The OJA could decline to ask for renewal, in which case it would then lapse. Does that make sense?
Okay. But it has... the renewal, if the OJA asks for it, is automatic. It would pretty much every value. I understand that part. Here's the question. Whether either party has to initiate a request for a renewal or an objection.
This that is what that question.
No. So here's the other part. This is too much, but the summary statement that goes to the hearing board chair put in the OJA's office like that and eliminate the need to go back to the respondent.
Yeah, which I think if we were to cut out the part in this thing says if the chair determines that a no contact directive is no longer necessary, you shall not cut all the way out until the last sentence if additional reviews are requested. To me, that makes more sense. Which accomplishes all the goals of the committee. Because if a no contact directive is not even necessary, that would be stop right away. So let's say we have a student who transfers because they don't want to adjudicate this matter here. There's a no contact directive that's going to be null and void, and the university would do a PNG, and the terms are permanent, at least no contact board versus a university no contact board. And so, one of the things that's in here is that you have to have that. And so when I request a suspension, for example, I say, here are the relevant facts, and that gets sent out to both sides of the parties. So I think where this is really tripping me up is, like I said, if we were able to cut, if the chair determines that no contact directive is no longer necessary, you should allow that all the way to then just leave that, those last two sentences. So just keep the first one, two, the first two, and then the last two.
Here's the one thing that we had discussed in the past was also not, it was, in terms of no necessity, wouldn't renew it. The concern that was brought forward was ensuring, making sure this also appears in the future, but sure the hearing board chairs know that you have the ability to modify it. That's not just a yes or no. As I come to it and say, okay, John Doe has entered the building through exit, meaning say I'd be able to determine tailor it. I know that the hearing board chair has that discretion, but otherwise, in terms of the committee to determine how they should retweak that language to make it as have the economy of being able to make it workable. So Ryan, were you raising your hand? I think we were pointing to that.
I want to make sure I have the, I think the only thing that I would keep in the two sentences that you were talking about, Michelle, is the parties being able to submit written statements. I agree with everything else, but I would want to make sure that if they wanted to include relevant information, they could as well.
Do you have any concerns about that being subpoenable additional records for?
Well, and that's why if they didn't want to, they wouldn't have to. But if new information came to light and it felt like, if the hearing chair can just see this information, at least the no contact order will go away. They can submit that if they want to.
So I was unclear. What were you agreeing with?
What my understanding is, Michelle is proposing to strike, starting with national advisor board line. If the chair determines that the no contact is no longer necessary, going that all the way through up until where it ends with may submit written comments, mm-hmm. and to, in essence, consider removing that. And I had raised a concern of potentially the inability for chair to modify it, and Ryan, but as it's a desire, my understanding is to leave the ability for parties to still submit optional written materials if they wanted to.
But you're saying you're fine with taking everything out except for that.
Sorry, you're right. Let me be clear. I agree with the concern about having to give everything to the hearing chair. Mm-hmm. I would want the hearing chair to be able to modify the no contact order and that power to be clear. Mm-hmm. And I would also want the parties to be able to submit anything that they found relevant in a written statement.
Thank you. Other comments?
I think this is good as written, but I understand the issue of access to all known investigative materials. I guess I've got
two points. One is if we want to leave out about any investigative materials, I guess we just say then, according to what Ryan was saying, in evaluating a renewal request, the parties to the director may submit, or you could just say something in the chair's evaluation of the renewal request, the parties may submit. That's your idea. Yeah. And I just want to be clear about then what, so the chair gets at this point a summary from the NJA's office, and the parties also get it after that.
Right now, there's nothing. So if there's a no contact directive, I would have out in circumstances, I would look at it at this health and safety. And like I said, I'd never have thought that that question was being asked.
I meant more in terms of like, I sort of lost the train of thought about what actually does happen now if you want to extend it.
I can just extend
it. So it's still, it's unilaterally within.
Yeah, usually you do. The best practices of conduct officials is that you keep a no contact record in place until circumstances change, until the requesting party has either made an alternate safety plan or thinks that their safety is not a concern, or you wait until the case is adjudicated to finish.
Okay. So didn't you refer to some sort of summary that you like that you give to the parties?
For the suspension.
Oh, for the suspension. Okay.
Other comments or concerns? So what I'm hearing from those present is to, in essence, the language I've noted, to remove the vast majority of it, except leaving the explicit ability to modification. I also may not suggest an act of quarter that's put an act of direct request of chief's honor to make sure that it's clear. I mean, in the case of the order, it was an order of protection that obviously will supersede whatever we do. And just to make sure that there's no ambiguity. But in essence, to otherwise remove the rest of that, leaving the modification and the ability to serve examines. I can even also treat the language names as optionally may submit to make it abundantly clear that they are not required. And in essence, then to leave the renewal process for the hearing board chairs, the rest there. If there's a concern, I mean, I also, the renewal process in terms of the different chair looking at it, I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to try and make it as clear as possible. And if there's five chairs, they run through. And once you stand, you can keep going around that circle as much as necessary. But the intent, hopefully, being that, A, you would almost never have to, but also make it clear to parties that, oh, we have five chairs. If we use all five chairs, it's not a magic automatic end.
So the proposal is to eliminate that sentence beginning in evaluating the renewal request?
No, it's the proposal is to, on the third line in the middle, the quotes, if the chair determines, actually, I'll read what's supposed to be eliminated.
Yeah.
If the chair determines that the no contact directive is no longer necessary, he or she shall not extend the directive. Should the chair choose to extend the directive, he or she may modify the directive's terms, but may not supersede the act of court order. In evaluating a renewal request, the chair shall have access to all relevant investigative materials, and the parties to the directive may submit written statements. The proposal is to remove that, and will retain two elements. Retaining the ability, in essence, the language saying that the hearing board chair may choose to modify the directive, as well as that the parties to the directive may submit written statements. And I would go to also clarify that they are the optional written statements and they're not required of the parties. It is clear. May is that
I don't think you need to say, you know, to say may.
Yeah. That's where we are. I know that we are over time. I know we started a little late. But what we do is we can read the work language on the floor. And if you'd like, I would do that. We can do that very quickly. This is a brief workshop. I don't think there'd be much change. Or we could wait until next week to look at it. My goal is to, once this is done, once this person is set aside, noting there's a couple of things here where chairs have looked at that we may consider, but to take what we've, in essence, already logged as preliminarily approved and start publicly posting it for comments and shopping around, noting the Office of the President is very emphatic about a desire to make sure that we have more comments, our goal is responsive. And on that, so okay, these are the, in essence, they still maybe change a little bit when we bring it all together, but here's what we're looking at. Start shopping around, I can talk to the student assembly, the very start talking to the assembly to make sure it's posted for comment so that when the time comes to put these through, we can go to the office president and say, we have done the following set for public comment. It's also partially why we make hearing board chairs, and just to make sure we have really dotted our eyes across our T's.
Do you need a motion for that?
Not necessarily. I mean, I would just do it because it's already been preliminary approved. Everything we do is already public. It's just a matter of myself taking an extra step to tell the office that please post the following document under X, Y, and Z, and then I will advertise it.
So all the bolded stuff on the last page,
mm-hmm.
I think it's fine. So.
So, I mean, if you'd like, what I can offer is, if you're willing to stick around for 3 or 4 minutes, I can, or we can actually, just retweak that language, of course, that are proposed to remove, have something, and then say this is, the committee feels ready. It's preliminary approved, so that I can present it to them, inform the UA we've done this. Again, noting that the hearing board chairs raised some concerns about language in the code. We're going to look at that next week to make sure that if the full size, I actually have the language we looked at 2 years ago, which is a lot of the proverbial back pocket. But that will be done next week, but we'd like to do that now.
I'll withdraw my motion. Okay. I guess we'll talk about on the whole side.
Okay. Sorry, Lisa, are you ready?
I tend not to like sort of trying to write things.
Efficient.
But the only thing that I wonder about is, do we need any language about what the chair may consider other than the parties submitting statements that they want? Mm-hmm. I mean, what does the chair consider?
That was a summary, I suppose.
Well, but that's what I was asking about. And I thought you were saying that it wouldn't be something. You just saying there isn't one now. I'm just unclear about what the chair would consider.
We're not getting everything, yeah. Which I can understand the reason, like, wouldn't get everything. What do they get to make sure they have an informed decision instead of just, I mean, clearly you would never say, please renew, full stop, but to try and ensure that, to try and, if possible, delay what they get, or to try and standardize that.
How about I send out that so I have a triage matrix that I use when I consider interim measures that might be a beneficial way for us to have this conversation. That I've been printed out tonight where I literally say I go through the elements of the code and then I add a couple additional ones about being an editor tailor and things of that nature. So maybe that'll be a starting point. I don't want to quickly do a code rewrite in a minute and a half. But what I'm hearing y'all say is that maybe the easiest way to fix this thing would be just to cross off and evaluate. So, in the sense of evaluating a renewal request and then cross off the chair may have access to all relevant materials and the parties, and just keep and evaluate a renewal request, the parties directly may submit written statements and just put it on the GA if they want to do that. But I'll send out the my info measures evaluation sheet. That maybe there's an appendix in the procedures or something like that.
If you did that, sure. Then they'd be getting nothing.
No, I would always submit something. I just wanted
to. You don't want to call it a summary.
Well, we could. I just.
You don't think it's necessary to put it in your code.
No, I think once you.
Because you're applying. So the fact that you're asking
that's fine.
For it.
That's fine.
Okay. I'm good with that.
So that sounds excellent. We're over time. What I'm going to do, as I said, I will rework some of the language based on what I just heard. I will circulate it. I won't say this even, but sometime, maybe hopefully by the end of by tomorrow, to the committee to say where are the thoughts with the eye that we'll still discuss this at our next meeting next week, but that I can start doing the public shopping of all the language, because noting that spring break is in 2 weeks, and after that it's a sprint to finish to make sure that these get done and get the public vetting. We keep an eye on the clock, so to speak. So as soon as I'll do that, Michelle will send that out, and I think we'll inform our discussion for next week. And we are actually hearing board applications. I'm also going to be contacting the Office of the Assemblies to see what we're doing with those. They went out last Wednesday. They've been circulated. And also, actually, I hope to follow up with the chairs to see, with our questions, to see if we're missing something in terms of ability to make a hard choice. Is it doing and fixing our questions? Right? Make sure we're aware. You may be, in essence, holding the keys to some of the career in your hand, then Are you comfortable doing that?
Yes, I just, with the questions, I usually make the point not to talk about the dream board questions, but I did notice in the one where it said, you know, the J made an error, the dream board not comfortable. And I felt like that was a little prejudicial to say if either side on the issue failed to follow the code, how would you build that side?
Right.
I think that was a little bit of not moving towards the direction we're trying to move to.
You mind sending me a question with a note after the email? Just so that, cause I have to say, my shoot is different. I see the note Steve Blue Ink, and I just want to make sure that's important, and that's a certain invalid. I mean, we even, also, I disclosed this last week. There was one question, and Michelle points out, we had adopted the last year. Hearings are generally on Tuesdays and Fridays, X date. For some reason, in the transition, when Mr. Fride ceased being chair and I took over, that question didn't make it through. I told the office that I did it pretty previously. Please include it. Michelle actually pointed it out. Being that it's a minor, I wanted to do that, but I also would like to see if it's aware. And we have some draft language, hopefully next week, about putting staffing processes in the UA bylaws, so that every year we have to bring at the wheel, which is a waste of time and effort, at least through communication. But we have to do this for your consent. That being said, are there any final comments or questions? I have to carry none. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you so much, everyone.
Yeah, I know. That's why I didn't get down. I don't know. Oh, I guess I borrowed it so that I could wave something if I